Hello, and I would like to welcome our listeners to another edition of the Crossroads Podcast. I'm Matt O'Brien, a reporter and senior editor for InfraLogic's North American coverage. I'll be your host today. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce our guest today, someone who's going to give us his view on some of the particular issues around digital infrastructure space we've been watching closely here at InfraLogic. Our regular readers have seen day in and day out. I have with me GI Partners Managing Director and co-head of the firm's data infrastructure strategy, Mark Privatuck. Mark, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be with you.
Likewise. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today. So data centers, fiber optics, right up there with renewable energy and energy transition opportunities, accounting for most M&A and capital raise volume the last year or two among all infra subsectors, according to our data. And it's no secret, you're a reader of InfraLogic, that GI Partners has been extremely busy buying and doing partial sell downs of assets lately. So I really wanted to get your take on a few things that I've been thinking about lately and all of us have internally. I think the best way to get the conversation going, I wanted to open up with development constraints. For a little while now, I've been listening to various digital infra operators, investors talk about a variety of constraints that are posing issues for greenfield development, whether it's power transmission lines or supply chain challenges, whatever have you. Mark, can you give me your take on this issue more broadly and how certain players are dealing with these issues?
Sure, Matt. I think the first thing to think about is the fact that in a number of areas across data infrastructure, we're in an environment of rapid expansion, the demand for capacity, not just data centers, which I know we're going to talk about, but also broadband connectivity to homes. We're seeing trends of growth and development and construction that are really unparalleled in our history, right? And so the strains that that pace of development puts on supply chains, on organizational infrastructures to manage these processes is something that we're all in the industry a bit learning as we go. And we're seeing rapid growth, but also not unexpectedly bumps in the road along the way. I think the most dramatic piece of this to talk about is in the data center side. And over the past decade plus, we've been engaged in a massive build cycle around the development of public cloud. And then over the past 18 months or so, since the rollout of ChatGPT, we've seen a tremendous amount of growth, particularly around generative AI, and in particular, generative AI training models. And we are in an environment where we've gone from a relative surplus of data center capacity going back to 2019, 2020, 2021, to an environment where we are now pretty significantly constrained in terms of supply to meet the coming demand. And that has created a dynamic where the constraints really depending on the market that we're talking about, but everything from availability of mechanical, electrical componentry equipment to sit in data centers, to breakers to sit in substations, to the availability of transmission to bring power generation to the locations where data center capacity is needed most.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Speaking of constraints, just getting a little bit more specific here, everyone has been following the challenges around procuring power for data center development. I think the issues with Dominion and Northern Virginia highlight that. And let's keep in mind what AI and advanced compute means for power demand. I was at the MetroConnect conference last week. I heard one of your peers, Mark Gonzi, said the industry is less than 15 or 16 years away where 80% of all data center power will be consumed by AI, whereas today, AI represents less than 10% of power consumed by data center. Can you talk to me what your expectations are for power demand for data center facilities and what that will look like going forward?
Yeah, so the numbers that we're looking at, Matt, suggest that we're going to have an aggregate increase of roughly 15 gigawatts of demand for data centers over the next 10 years. Sorry, not even 10 years, next 5 or 6 years, through 2030. That's roughly a doubling from where we are today. So if you think about all the data center capacity that's been constructed over the past, call it 25, 30 years, and now over the next 5 years, we're going to double that. It necessarily is putting strains on the system, And the reality is, you know, data centers are located in fairly significant clusters. So, you know, while we may have sufficient power generation, sufficient power supply across the country, what matters is, do you have sufficient power supply and the means by which to get that power to the relevant data center locations within a particular cluster or close enough to that cluster for the relevant applications to run. And so that's really what we're seeing here in Northern Virginia, for instance, and increasingly in other markets as well. In Dallas, the area surrounding Dallas, surrounding Atlanta, you know, Columbus, Ohio, markets that you would never have thought about being constrained all of a sudden on the basis of all the demand flowing primarily from generative AI at this point are causing some significant questions about where that is going to come from.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess we'll see how that pans out. Hey, listen, on the A side of things, artificial intelligence, can you give me some use cases driven by AI that will help our listeners how to think about how that technology will shape the digital infra sector in the years ahead?
What we're seeing use cases from AI today and in our own investments within GI data infrastructure, we're seeing AI have significant impacts in customer care. For instance, within our fiber businesses, AI is performing diagnostics on Wi-Fi routers inside customers' homes and identifying those routers that are likely to break down in a reasonable period of time. And then sending technicians that are on the road to say, hey, if you are doing a customer call that happens to be within a few blocks of a customer that today their system's working fine, but we think within the next few weeks it's likely to break down, drop off a new router today rather than rolling another truck a few weeks from now. That's a pretty incredible improvement, number one, the customer experience. Right, they never have to go a day without an operable, you know, operable home internet. But from the standpoint of the company and the cost structure, those truck rolls are expensive. It's the time for a technician, it's fuel for the truck. And going back to what we said at the top of the podcast, in an environment where there's a tremendous amount of growth around new build, new installations, if we can keep those technicians focused on installing new customers rather than doing repairs for existing customers, that's a big win. Another area where we see a lot of real benefit today from AI is around what we typically would call the Internet of Things, and we refer to it as tech-enabled infrastructure. So businesses that take sensors, meters, cameras, collections of connected devices, collecting millions, if not billions, of data points every day, and pulling that data, aggregating it, and using AI to identify patterns in that behavior are enabling businesses to generate real return on investment in those IoT deployments. For instance, one of our portfolio companies, which, you know, provides sensors that are used on transport and logistics assets, the customer was able to recognize a 45% reduction in fuel costs by optimizing delivery routes, utilizing the data provided from the sensors on their fleet of vehicles. So not only are we able to use all that data to demonstrate, you know, to identify patterns of behavior, recommend specific fixes or decisions to optimize business operations, but also to calculate very clear returns on investment to those companies. And that really creates a virtuous circle where those companies are then more inclined to make those investments because they can very clearly demonstrate in an environment where, you know, capital costs are higher, you've got an attractive return on investment there.
That's incredible. Very, very interesting stuff.
I'd say that is what we refer to as machine learning, what the two examples I just described. When we talk about generative AI, we're just starting to scratch the surface. But, you know, the numbers that we see suggest trillions of dollars of economic value created in the space, significant opportunities that we're starting to see around the medical industry, you know, in terms of development of pharmaceuticals, you know, significant opportunities that we're seeing, and we're starting to see this roll out in terms of marketing and sales efforts, utilizing generative AI to create better sales scripts, you know, that are tailored specifically to the psychometrics that appeal to different customer bases. And so this is all very, very much in the early days, but the applicability across a range of industries is immense.
Thanks for that. Yeah, all very interesting stuff we'll be keeping tabs on, certainly. I want to talk to you about fiber to the home. So we're just going to pivot here slightly. We've been seeing a number of incumbents pull back on pro forma passings for 24, given the cost environment and probably some other factors. Look, it's an industry that's CapEx intensive, still needing massive investment to broaden fiber's reach across North America, North American market, and US, what, another, I think it's 55% of the country still doesn't have fiber access. Can you give me your outlook on the industry against this backdrop?
We still think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity here. And, you know, we're very happy with the businesses that we've invested in that are providing residential broadband to customers, various regions across the U.S. I think it's important to distinguish between competitive, you know, highly competitive markets, which tend to be more urban or, you know, near suburban markets, and markets that are still fundamentally underserved, which tend to be smaller communities, sometimes more rural, less population density. I think where we've seen, you know, cuts in the forecast from some of the strategics are largely in places where, number one, they've done the work to assess the cost to build, and that cost to build is high relative to the competitive intensity of a given market. And so it's not unexpected that where you have a number of, or not maybe not a number, but multiple competing announcements of build in a particular community, it is a what we sometimes refer to as a land grab. And the first one to put the backhoe in the ground is the one who's going to win that customer. And in many cases, it's no longer economic for player number two to start their build. So you would expect to see some reductions in, you know, in the announced passings, just driven by that competitive dynamic. And that's good, right? That's rational behavior by market participants not to overbuild where you're less likely to achieve an economic return. So we applaud that. We're also seeing, you know, the dynamics of increased cost, right? Inflation has been has had a meaningful impact on this industry. And that's everything from increasing labor rates to increasing the cost of componentry. And, you know, while inflation is slowing, those costs are still fundamentally meaningfully higher than they were when a lot of those original build forecasts were being put out, you know, call it 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, right. And others have told me similar. When you talk about overbuilding, a couple of months ago, we put out, well, maybe more than that, but we put out a story on fiber optic players beginning to tap the ABS market, right? And overbuild was one of the concerns, if you see that, could impact ABS cash flows. So that's one trend I want to bring up with you and get you on the record here on what your outlook is. Fiber executives looking to tap this financing mechanism. So what are some of the opportunities and risks that you see?
The reason you see companies tapping that market is that, you know, and it goes back to, again, what we were talking about at the very beginning, we're in this period of unprecedented expansion, and that expansion is highly capital intensive. There are limits to what can be accommodated within the traditional commercial bank markets. And therefore, you know, it's very logical to ask, okay, where do we go once we've aggregated a base of operations that's sufficiently diverse and sufficiently stable to support a long-term financing solution like the ABS market? And so, you know, we've had success within GI accessing the ABS market for some of our businesses. I do think it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, these markets work best when we're talking about businesses that are very, very predictable, that are benefiting from, you know, from contracted cash flows, or, you know, again, a highly diverse customer base where you've got a very reliable stream of cash flows over a very long period of time. We've seen the expansion of this market into, you know, certainly retail fiber to the home. Some of the markets that are best, or some of the revenue models that are best positioned to take advantage, are revenue models that rely on contracted streams of cash flow through, for instance, sales to homeowner associations or condo associations, where the revenue stream is actually built into the residence annual dues, as opposed to a competitive retail environment. And, you know, I think we'll be interested to watch how that market continues to evolve for more traditional retail. The number of players that have tapped it for that purpose, pretty limited today. We do expect that to grow. But again, that really is dependent on achieving significant scale. And there are, you know, I think a smaller number of at least the sponsor-backed providers today that have the requisite scale for that.
Let's keep the focus on financing. There's a lot of talk about the data center and even fiber optic industries using project finance. This is an area where the reporters and research analysts are pretty comfortable with project finance. We were pretty much founded as a project finance trade news publication many, many years ago. Now, project finance is usually costlier than, you know, the loan or bond market to fund buildouts in this case. You know, and I thought it was interesting, you know, when you and I were talking about doing this, you told me you started your career out in project finance. So now I'm very interested to see how you answer this. But talk to me about why the digital infra sector is pursuing this type of financing.
It's pretty simple. And the reason that parties utilize project finance is when the risk associated with a particular project not going well, right? A risk of failure puts at risk the financial wherewithal of the entire enterprise. And so if you're an owner of a business, you never want to make a kind of franchise bet, right? And we're in an environment now where particularly in the data center space, the scale of the developments, the scale of the data center campuses being requested by the hyperscalers, the Amazons, Googles, Microsofts, we're now talking about hundreds of megawatts. We're talking about projects that, you know, on an individual project basis can be in the billions of dollars. And when you're at that scale, the risk of a failure or the risk, you know, from the standpoint of a lender or the standpoint of a developer can put an entire company at risk. And so when you're in that position, you can utilize project finance to allocate the risks to those parties that are best able to handle those, right? And to finance on a non-recourse basis, where, you know, you're looking directly at the lessee, for instance, for the revenue stream rather than the credit of the developer. And in this case, that makes sense because those lessees, again, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Googles, are some of the largest and most creditworthy companies in the entire world. And as high quality of businesses, even some of the largest data center, you know, developers and operators are, they're nowhere near the scale or creditworthiness of those customers. So, you know, in that case, project finance becomes a very attractive means of raising money. The other dynamic here is just the sheer amount of money that needs to be raised. And, you know, that is a relatively large market where, you know, you're seeing borrowers access funding, not just from the big, you know, traditional project finance banks that are used to funding, you know, roads and airports and power generation projects, but you're also seeing them approach traditional real estate markets for financing.
Right. Gotcha. So we've mentioned ABS, project finance. I'm pretty sure conventional bank lenders and private credit funds won't sit idle. Mm-hmm. How you see these competitive dynamics playing out for both sides, yeah, borrower and lender?
We operate in the mid-market. GI's investment strategy is really focused on investing in businesses that are, you know, measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars rather than the billions of dollars. For us, the commercial bank markets are still quite robust. But again, you know, as we think, sort of pull the lens back and look industry-wide, there is a very significant need to continue expanding the pool of available capital resources. And I think that looking at the bond markets, you know, the private placement markets, which support multiples of financing capacity year in, year out, as compared to what we see, let's say, in the ABS market, is a very logical place to go. So, you know, I think if we look at the total volume of ABS that's been done, you know, over the past few years around data centers, fiber, tower businesses, obviously tower space has been accessing this market for many, many years, but we're talking about $10 billion a year, maybe $12 billion a year. That pales in comparison to the overall scale of the, you know, the private market, the private placement market. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this continues to evolve. But without a doubt, in order to meet the needs of the construction and expansion, you know, boom that we're in, and that will continue over the next several years, we need those new sources of capital to show up.
Gotcha. Yeah, thanks for that. Go back to a little bit, we were talking about the risk sharing component behind project finance. You know, when I was listening to operators, investors talk about project finance for their respective projects, I also hear them discuss risk transfer. This is a big theme at our USP3 conference. always hear on multiple panels throughout the course of the two-day event, risk transfer, which means, you know, the project partners sharing of various risks among partners, counterparties, off-takers. When I was at the Metro Connect conference, you know, and this topic kept coming up, I mean, the panelists, it was like being back at USP3 again. The conversations were very similar. Again, at InfraLogic, like I said, we've been listening to these discussions for years among core infra investors and public procurement officials. What can you expand on that risk sharing, that risk transfer mechanism for project done as project finance? What's this going to look like within the digital infra sector?
I don't think it looks fundamentally different from the way project finance looks for any other, you know, in its sector. Essentially, what you're doing is you're taking the risks associated with a project, whether that's procurement of critical equipment, construction, offtake, right, or in the context of a data center, the lease counterparty, and the operations, and assigning those risks to the parties that are best able to handle that particular risk. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the sheer size of these projects. And, you know, even though risk of failure is very low on any one given risk factor, the impact of a failure when you're talking about a $1 billion project on any given company is immense, right? So it's only by dividing those risks and apportioning them to the parties that are best able to handle them contractually that you're able to achieve successful project financing. In that regard, you know, data centers are no different from the asset classes that have been project financed for the past 40 or 50 years now, you know, whether that's pipelines or roads or, you know, or airports or renewable energy projects.
Last question for you. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about M&A. So M&A generally, you know, last year and a half, maybe even 2 years, has been slow for well-advertised reasons. What's your predictions for 24 and 25 and some of the drivers of that activity?
We're looking forward to a pretty robust 2024 and onward. You know, a couple factors at play. Number one, and again, I mean, you know, not to repeat myself, but the sheer capital intensity of this cycle that we're in, and we will continue to be in for the next many years, and whether that's driven by the need for broadband connectivity in homes and businesses, or the growth of generative AI, or the mass adoption of IoT solutions. That requirement of capital is a catalyst for transaction activity. And so, you know, companies, even if they don't like where valuations are, or owners of companies, I should say, even if they don't like where valuations are today relative to maybe high water marks that we saw in terms of multiples in 2 years ago, at some point that need for capital is the overwhelming driver and, you know, creates a dynamic where, you know, where people will come to the market. The other thing is we're just in a fundamentally more stable economic environment, it feels like today, than we were 12 or 18 months ago. Inflation has moderated, right? Interest rates have stabilized. You know, we'll see if they come down or not. But an environment of, you know, greater stability allows a greater likelihood that buyers and sellers can, you know, can come to agreement on valuations. So we're feeling pretty good about the market upcoming.
Got it. Yeah, I think we are too. I look forward to covering a lot more deals that are coming for sure. Well, hey, listen, that's all I got for you, Mark. That takes care of it.
All right. Thanks for having me, Matt.
You got it. I want to thank our guest and our listeners for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Crossroads Podcast, and we'll see you next time.